on the occasion of Mother's Day, I thought it might be interesting to explore one of the world's most unusual religious examples of motherhood, the birth of Buddha. In order to understand this, we have to depart, it seems to me, from most of the historical traditions and realize that from the beginning in India, practically every personification or personality involved in religious literature is present not as a person, but as the personification of a principle. The whole fable account, as we find it in the East, is a series of personifications. In the West, we think of these stories as historically true, although mystics have already done considerable to interpret the mystical experience of Jesus as a symbol of the Christ in ourselves. In India, this practice was followed from the most remote times and descended from Hinduism gradually into Buddhism. Some feel that Buddhism is a reformed Hinduism. This is not really true. I don't feel it, at least personally. I rather feel that Buddhism is simply a restatement of the basic principles which are found in the symbolism of Hinduism. In other words, the Buddhist is simply the continuation of a process of interpretation. To go back again to the original pictures, the original concepts, and trace them to their universal sources. The early Brahmins were among the first to chart the structure of the universe. Long before Western man was interested in such matters, the savants of India and China had already more or less organized a concept of existence that survives with some modifications to the present time. Perhaps one of the most important differences between Eastern and Western astronomy is that in the East, the universe is alive. The universe is a living entity. The universe is both a principle and a being. It is not simply an aggregate of chemical processes. The very atmosphere of space is alive. Everything that involves change and backs the processes of evolution and involution, every law of the universe is alive. There is no such a thing as a mechanistic concept in ancient Hinduism. There were a few materialistic scholars, but they never made much influence or had much to do with the forming of Indian thought. So we have the universe conceived as an entity, a vast being whose body nature is and God the soul. Everything is ensouled by a divine power. Everything is a manifestation of an infinite invisible. So the universe becomes the great symbol of the eternal from which it emerges. And therefore it was inevitable that in old Hinduism that science and religion should be considered as one form of knowledge, because to them there could be no science without religion and no religion without the cosmic science, which was the principal heritage of ancient India. Living in a universe of aliveness was a tremendous challenge to the mortal mind of man, a challenge which has never been fully accepted, even in India. The average Hindu is no more able to fully comprehend the vastness of his own theology than is the Westerner capable of understanding the overtones of his own sciences. Each is locked in a kind of literalism. In the East, this literalism is mythology. In the West, this literalism is materialism. The average person does not go beyond the surfaces of things. And the surfaces of things fall short or are inadequate to meet the unfolding need of human consciousness. So in the ancient system, it was necessary to provide a key to an unfolding theory that could never be outgrown. The theory of an eternally growing, operating, living creation. That what we might term a cosmic being is actually a form of consciousness, of intelligence, and of enlightenment above and beyond mind. In India, for instance, mind was regarded very largely as the slayer of the real. Most individuals live by preconceptions, either their own or of the environment in which they live. We are taught these preconceptions from society, from schools, from practically every contact we have with each other. We live in a small universe in which the intimate average thing is paramount. Most human beings live from the cradle to the grave, without really having an abstract thought about themselves or anything else. They do not live in a vast world of living powers. They live in a store, in a marketplace, in a trading center. And their lives are fulfilled in the daily tasks of continuing an existence which really has very little substance behind it. The existence of trying to get out of this life as comfortably as possible. This is the primary concern of some. For others, the concern is to have as much as you can while you're here, although fully realizing that you cannot take it with you. Now, in Asia, these concepts were not so real as they are here. It's true that in India and China and most of the Asiatic countries, there were very extravagant personalities. There were nobilities that were wastrel from the beginning. There were many who amounted to little or nothing. And many of the very wealthy were among the poorest citizens of the East. These things were all true, and are true even now. But beneath it all was a great layer of what might be termed the people. The average Indian, the average Chinese, the average Japanese. He belonged to a great structure of believing. And on his own level, he examined more closely than his peers the type of inward life with which he had been endowed. It was this contemplation of internals and eternals that resulted in India producing a almost complete race of sages, holy men, ascetics, yogis, those who were struggling to make the invisible on the inside more real and give them a victory over an exterior which was difficult, sad, and problem-bound. There's been estimated that at the time of the taking over of India by the present democratic regime, that there were more than 9 million self-appointed religious wanderers. These were not all foolish people. They were trying to find out something. What they were trying to find out was in their sacred books, but they never had realized it. It constituted a different approach to reality, a different way of measuring life and measuring success. We have it in the West in monastic orders, which particularly in early centuries of Christianity were very powerful. In these monastic orders, human beings turned from the temporal to the eternal and found in this a strange mystical fulfillment, something that the temporal world could not bestow. Many were led to religion by disillusionment, by suffering, by pain, by bereavement. All these things led the individual away from the daily and the ordinary into the search for something deeper and more important. We are beginning to feel this situation now, because in the presence of the great changes that are taking place, with nuclear fission hanging over the world, with practically every system that we have proving its deficiency in many, many respects, with the average individual not enjoying nearly the security of his grandparents, there's been a great recognition of the fallibility of a materialistic way of life. And all over the Western civilization at this time, there is an arising of mysticism, of a search for a spiritual value. And more persons are being disillusioned as to the importance of ways which they accepted without question a few years ago. Now, to go back to our India problem, we have in this situation more or less the problem that faced India. Because in India, the great Brahmanic system of theology was a science based upon a religion. This science resulted in the fantastic structure of a caste system, a system which perhaps had many infallibles that will soon be forgotten, but also had certain points of value that have to be considered. The caste system divided humanity into four levels or general structures. The highest of these was the scholar and the sage. In the caste system, wealth was not included among the important patterns of career. Below the wise, the second caste, was the defender of the wise. And the purpose of this defender was to make sure that wisdom itself was never profaned, that there was never a time when the highest was not protected and guarded. This might cause some thought today, where if we suddenly came to the realization that militarism was part of a caste in India dedicated entirely to the protection of truth in its abstract form. In other words, it wasn't who won the battle. It was to protect the eternal values of universal law, to protect what we would term the Ten Commandments, the defenders of the faith of righteousness. Then the third caste was what we would call today average people. These were the ones who were the shopkeepers, the workers, the agriculturists, all those who had to do with the maintenance of the living standard of the people, the work people of the world, who were entitled to very high recognition for this. Those who loved to labor, and to whom labor was a religion, to serve others, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to heal the sick. These were the labors of mankind, and these were the labors primarily of the third caste, the caste that was concerned with making sure that the universal law was fulfilled in the commonplace, in the marketplace, in the store, in the home, and in the life of the average person who is never going to transcend a level of utilities. And the last caste was that of the outcast, the Sudra. This was the caste not of the people primarily, not originally the people, who were born of a lower order. The Sudra was the individual who by nature was common, who by nature had no ideals and no integrities, who drifted about and became the basis of the unemployable, the criminal, and all those who preferred, in a sense, to remain unenlightened, to live as slaves to their own ignorance, and by this circumstance, ending slaved by others. The Sudra represents, therefore, a person who, regardless of wealth, regardless of station, regardless of opportunity, goes from the cradle to the grave with no interest in the well-being of anyone except himself and his own. The individual to whom selfishness is a way of life, because selfishness is a supreme form of ignorance. The man who does not go to school may be learned. The man who is selfish is always ignorant. So these situations, taken literally, became more or less ridiculous. But lifted up to their level of principles, they had truths that are useful even in our day. Now, in the ancient system of thinking, we know that Buddhism, coming in, had as its purpose a transforming of certain Indian, East Indian symbolism into what later became Buddhist symbolism. The Buddhists did not destroy the gods of the Hindus, nor turn against them, nor declare them to be untrue or unreasonable. The Buddhist point of view was that these gods of the Hindus were not gods at all, except by man's appointment. He created them in the image of himself and bestowed most of his own virtues and vices upon his deities. These were attitudes, these were opinions, these were misinterpretations of principles. But the principles themselves, if they could be cleared, would be very noble and beautiful. It was just a case where, as the Buddhist point of view takes it, it was necessary to convert the gods of India and make Buddhists out of them. Make Buddhas out of the gods of India. Now, it was considered to be a little tricky, but it happened so smoothly, so gently, that it was merely a matter of deepening meanings. There was no conflict, really, between the conversion of the Hindu to Buddhism in the ancient time. He could accept it or not as he pleased. It wasn't important. But gradually, out of this situation, there rose a new estimation of the principles and purposes of deities. That these deities were in reality very much like the great aristocrats of the material world. Today we have a tendency to regard with great veneration the leaders we ourselves have created. We open the door for the advancing politician. We have great respect for our leaders, for our actors, for our school teachers, for all classes of persons that we have created, and we have tremendous respect for the wealth. Wealth becomes a kind of honorary degree in the life of everyone who gains it. So we take a very humble position in the presence of wealth, very seldom questioning how the wealthy person got it, or what he's going to do with it, or the trouble he's having with it himself. These things pass lightly. Now, in the Indian system, the old Vedic gods became more or less man-created aristocrats. They were based upon principles that were true. But in the course of time, the believers limited and narrowed down the qualities and attributes of their deities, changing embodied principles into personalities. It was part of the purpose of Buddhism to reverse this motion and to restore what it originally was intended to be, that all deities, like all mortals, are servants of truth, that the supreme purpose of the deity is the improvement of his creation, that he must be constant and continuously mindful of the needs of the creatures over which he has temporary government. These deities were therefore the Maharajas, the world kings, and they were honored and recognized, but Buddhism was a little leery of them. It recognized also that the tendency of the world king was to create more and more temporal empire. He wanted larger kingdoms. He wanted to conquer his neighbors. And while claiming to be a good Buddhist, or claiming to be a devout Hindu, he went out and made war upon his brothers. These things Buddhism recognized as deficiencies due to lack of one important factor. Namely, that true religion is an internal experience. And without this internal experience, nearly everything else is inadequate. The term Buddha, of course, it comes from an ancient Sanskrit term, which means enlightened. Therefore, Buddha is not primarily a person, but a state of enlightenment, a condition. Now, the same might be true also if we consider the Western philosophies and religions. We may personify Jesus Christ, but a Christian has to live the philosophy, live that religion. Christ is perfected in the Christian. And in the East, Buddha is embodied in the person who keeps the rules. Now, the rules are very, very simple, basically, because enlightenment is a condition that arises from a series of changes in the character and conduct of individuals. Therefore, we find the story brought into focus that Surya, the sun god, the god of all light, had a consort in Hinduism who carried the name of Maya. This consort was the feminine aspect of the sun. It was not originally a lunar divinity, but it was simply the transmission of light. It was not something inferior, something secondary, something dependent. It was, for the power that it personified, simply fulfillment. Everything that is right has to be fulfilled. Laws are made, but they must be kept. The knowledge is accumulated, but it must be interpreted in terms of common good. So in the ancient system, Surya, the sun, was the principle of infinite universal light, the light of reality. A light that is very different from just the sun ball that we see in the sky. Surya was the light of the world. It was that power which bestowed upon everything that existed not only the power of life, but the power of intelligence, and ultimately the actuality of salvation. In other words, it was the creator, the preserver, and the redeemer. It was the infinite reality upon which all other things depend. It is the light in things that make them live. It is the light in our eyes that makes us read a book correctly. It is light in our heart that gives us love. It is light everywhere that transforms the darkness of ignorance, selfishness, perversity, fear, into a radiant internal enlightenment. This means, as even the Western mystics have clearly shown, a change in what man sees when he looks. The individual who is not enlightened looks upon a world of difficulties. The enlightened person looks upon a world in which universal principles are fulfilling themselves, regardless of whether we like it or not. But it is perfectly possible for the individual to enter into an intimate association or comradeship with this light. So in the beginning in this system, we have light. And this light becomes the principle which is not visible light, physical light, such as we can see, but a light that transforms the inner life of everything that lives. A light that shines through the darkness of every uncertainty, imperfection, and incompleteness. Now, according to this concept, then, Maya would be this light in manifestation. The light per se is in the sun deity, but this light in manifestation becomes the instrument of the enlightenment of everything that lives. Therefore, Maya is not a secondary power. It is the Shakti is not merely a dependent. It is, in this case, a principle that can only manifest through an appropriate vehicle. And that appropriate vehicle is creation. And over this creation and all that it possesses and all that it contains is the principle of this one light coming home in everything that lives. Therefore, Maya is the fulfillment of the divine purpose, as that purpose is represented by the eternal maternal principle. In the Indian philosophy, finally, in spite of what we may think to the contrary, if we go back far enough to the roots of the Vedas and the great teachings of India, we find that the eternal space itself, the infinite potential theater for the existence of things, that which is the root of everything and from which everything must come and to which it must return, is a feminine power. This represents the inevitable state of birth and rebirth, both of which are feminine potentials. In this sense, therefore, we see the gradual transmission of this concept of Surya and Maya into the development of Buddhist legendary and lore. This legendary and lore divides abruptly into two schools, the northern and the southern. The southern school is far less florid than the northern. The southern school teaches that the only way that the individual can release himself from the great cycle of responsibilities and escape from the illusion of materiality is by entering holy orders, because casting off all worldly possessions and going forth in humility and unworldliness along a path that must lead through the whole of life to death. Only when there is a complete renunciation of all material things can the curse of Mara, the lord of illusion, be broken. About the beginning of the Christian era, in the northlands of India, on the borders probably of China, a new branch of Buddhism slowly emerged. This branch undoubtedly emerged because of the impact of the Buddhist principle upon the consciousness of its own believers. There was no inconsistency. There was no misinterpretation. There was simply a new realization of relationships in which it became no longer necessary to assume that the great invisible cause, this eternal life, this infinite light, was tyrannical. There was no reason to assume that reality or truth must be cruel. There was no idea or realization that it was necessary to be punished forever for the sins of the fathers. That there was no hope except by this strange path of renouncing everything, including self. As a result of this change of perspective, the second school, which became the Northern School, or the Mahayana, became tremendously important in the growth of Asiatic peoples. One of the simplest examples of this point is the Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara, known in Japan and China as Kanlan or Kuan Yin, the Goddess of Mercy. It began in India as a male being, and early representations of it, even in China, are androgynous. But gradually, it became a new being, for it was suddenly recognized or understood that mercy was strangely a heart aspect, that it was something, therefore, that belonged not to the creative processes, but to the redemption and release of creatures. And in this course of procedure across Asia, this deity became feminine, and is as feminine is recognized today among all Buddhist peoples. This constant motion, therefore, toward the feminine principle as beauty, as love, and of grace, of forgiveness, of kindness, of dedication, resulted in the Northern school developing an interpretation of the Buddhist teaching which is essentially happy, a joyous philosophy, a philosophy not built upon death or martyrdom, or sorrow or loss, but a philosophy based upon fulfillment, based upon the idea that doing the right thing is the most wonderful and radiant way to be happy. Then only other one problem remained, how to know what is the right thing and how to find ways of understanding it. And to meet this, we have the story of the birth of Buddha, in which a certain number of very interesting factors not generally considered enter. According to one of the fables, and there are many, by the way, and some of them are in apparent conflict, but not if you think them through. In the beginning, Surya, the god of the sun, this being the infinite light, not the light that is physical or temporal, but the light that comes with every being who comes into the world. This light, Surya, approached the queen of a little kingdom in what is now southern Nepal, and being a very courteous thing, never being bombastic or tyrannical or despotic, the eternal light asked Maya the privilege of being born through her. He wouldn't do it. It wouldn't do it if she didn't want it that way. And at first she rather objected to the idea. But after a very beautiful story was told, she accepted and agreed that she would become the mother of the embodiment. Now, what was going to be embodied? In one school, the embodied being was a bodhisattva, a being approaching perfection, who had voluntarily accepted the ministry of coming into the world for the redemption of mankind. Another view of the entire principle was quite different. Instead of being a person, this Buddha was actually Bodhi. In other words, infinite soul power, seeking to be born as the redeemer of all that lives. Now, in the categories, particularly those we find also in Yoga and Vedanta, we have a triad of which Bodhi represents infinite benevolence. Bodhi is the love that has no imperfection, no distortion, no selfishness, no self-interest. It is infinite love, infinitely manifesting throughout space as the proof of the presence of the divine power. In other words, manifesting always through love. The eternal light comes into the life of the individual. Therefore, the immaculate birth of Buddha is also very symbolical of the immaculate birth of truth in the human soul. This is the purpose of the story. It is that we should suddenly come to realize that we must personally accept the invitation to bring into our own lives and through our lives into the world a manifestation of infinite love. Now, in the story, of course, we have the case of the Immaculate Conception again. The Buddha enters into Maya's body through the right side on a lotus throne supported by an elephant, which was Ganesha, the symbol of wisdom, the symbol of propriety. In the Indian mythology, Ganesha was quite an interesting character who gradually became much involved in merchandising. But the real truth behind Ganesha was wisdom, but wisdom as integrity. Wisdom was useless if it did not create honor. Wisdom was meaningless if the wise were not good. Now, wisdom, assumedly, cannot be attained without virtue. Therefore, worldly wisdom, as we find in the story of Pilgrim's Progress can't be real wisdom at all. But in wisdom, the Bodhisattva was brought into the body of Mahamaya. And at that same instant, a blue lotus flower was placed in her hand as the symbol of the Annunciation. And of course, it's interesting that many European figures, the Virgin Mary, at the time of the Annunciation, is given a lily by the angel. This lily is again part of the same thing. And in the case also Mahamaya, we find another interesting parallel. She is associated very closely with the moon, which in a mysterious way is under her feet. Anyway, Mahamaya becomes the mother of the Buddha. She is purity becoming the mother of truth. She is that which is undefiled, becoming the basis and the power of redemption. And undefiled means finally and ultimately that all conduct is motivated by integrity, that all affection is honorable, and that in love and love alone can the true human being be brought into embodiment with the greatest potential for growth. Now the time came, and the king of the little country where Maya was the queen knew of the story and became acceptant of it and believed her account. And in due time, when her term was complete, they went to a beautiful garden called the Limbini Garden near his palace, where grew the painless tree, the tree that there was no suffering. She reached up her hand to pick a branch from this tree, and the child was born from her right side. Now, this is quite an interesting account for the reason that in all probabilities, we have to understand that Gautama Buddha was born or delivered by a Caesarean delivery. This is the only thing that would account for the detail, and also account for the fact that it's carefully recorded that the mother died within 7 days. This would be very likely true of a Caesarean done at that time. So we find that instead of being brought up by his mother, he was brought up by his aunt. And this aunt became also the wife of the king, and together they raised the child. Now, in this particular story, we find another interesting thing, which I think tells us something of the mythology involved. When the child was born, at the moment of birth, it was caught in a cloth held by the gods Indra and Brahma. And at the same time, the skies opened and the dragons of space anointed the child. Then, as only a few minutes old, the child walked. And he took 7 steps in each of the 4 directions and then returned to his native infancy. And the Chinese indicated these steps by putting a flower where each one of the 7 footprints in each direction was placed. And in the old woodblock prints, the flowers are arranged in the form of the cross. This is another interesting point that has generally been ignored. But it is all part of a story that goes far deeper than we're inclined to think. Actually, the continuation of the life of Buddha goes into a whole complication of situations. His aunt, who raised him, becomes one of his first converts. And this is regarded as an indication of his true attitude on conversion. Also, his own son, who was called the delayer or the postponer, was converted. And Rahula was born on the day in which Buddha received enlightenment. All these stories all fit together to make a story. They're very important. Actually, therefore, we find the development of the boy following a concept of picture, following the ancient customs always but strangely breaking through them into the destiny that was intended. In the Indian Eastern situation of Buddhism, we find, therefore, many accounts of Mahamaya. At the time of the child's birth and her own decease, she retired from the world into the Tushita heaven, where Buddha himself had waited for embodiment. This heaven was 33 steps above the earth. And when Buddha came back to his father's house to preach and convert the king after he had finished his own enlightenment, one of the first things that he did was to ascend the 33 steps and preach the doctrine of redemption to his own mother. This was his second contact with her. There was one contact after this, after his own death. After Buddha died and the disciples had gathered about the great wooden casket in which the body was placed prior to cremation, the mother, attended by celestial beings, descended from the Tushita heaven to mourn for the death of her son. And as she stood beside the casket in prayer and weeping, the casket opened and the Buddha rose to console her. Therefore, he rose from the dead to bless his own mother. These legends and these fables go on and on and on, but they are all trying to tell us something. And it is what they're trying to tell us, it seems to me, that is the most important of all. Actually, in the 8th century A.D., the Buddhist monk Kobodaichi went to China, where he received enlightenment, and where he brought back to Japan a great many relics and sacred things belonging to the Chinese Buddhist assembly. Among the things that he brought back was a tiny image of Maya Bunin, the mother of Buddha. And this image was placed in a little temple that was built on a hill overlooking the city of Kobe, in Japan. And this is called the White Moon Temple, or the Temple of the Lunar Crescent. And this temple is still in existence from the 8th century, and is either now in the Shingong or the Tendai jurisdiction, perhaps both. And every year, there is a special and wonderful ceremony given there to honor the mother of Buddha.